This is a download from the BBC.
Welcome to The Forum, a world of ideas from the BBC. Hello, I'm Bridget Kendall. We're teetering on the edge of nothingness today in our universe, peering into the fantastical realm of the very, very big and the very, very small. With me in the studio is one of Britain's best-known mathematicians, Ian Stewart. Joining us from Brussels is Belgian theatre director Alexander de Vrindt. But we start with Lawrence Krauss, joining us from Washington, celebrated cosmologist at Arizona State University and a popular science writer. And Lawrence, your latest book, Universe from Nothing, tackles some of the biggest questions of all, including when we look out from our planet into the cosmos, what exactly is that seemingly empty space? Because actually it's thought that it isn't really empty space with nothing in it at all, is it?
Well, actually, the amazing thing is it does have nothing in it, but it still weighs something. That's the strange and ridiculous reality of the universe.
And how do we know that it weighs something?
Well, because we can weigh it. And we can weigh it using gravity, and that's the way we weigh things in general. And it turns out it's remarkable that if you put energy into empty space, and only into empty space, then it's very different than any other kind of energy. Because Einstein told us that mass and energy produce a gravitational effect. In fact, they curve space in principle. But if you put energy in empty space, it sort of blows instead of sucking. It's gravitationally repulsive instead of attractive. It's like an anti-gravity. It's the only kind of energy that is gravitationally repulsive. And when we actually have looked out at the universe, we find out not only is it expanding, but that expansion is speeding up, as if there's a repulsive force pushing the universe ever further into greater scales and every object away from every other object. And that speeding up tells us that empty space has energy.
And this is what cosmologists nowadays call dark energy, isn't it?
Yes, because we're so creative, because we can't see it, so we call it dark energy.
Which accounts for 70% of mass in the universe, right?
70% of the total energy of the universe. Most of the universe is nothing. And it's the dominant stuff in the universe. Again, one of the lessons I hope that your listeners will take is that by the end of this program is that they're much more insignificant than they really thought they were.
But how do you know it's there?
Well, as I say, we do all the tests. I mean, it's sort of like if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And there's two ways. One, we've sort of directly detected it. We've observed the expansion of the universe speeding up. But that alone is so weird that you might say, well, maybe we're making a mistake because this stuff is difficult. But the other way to do it is to, because mass can curve space and energy can curve space, we can ask what the total curvature of the universe is. And we can weigh all of the galaxies by looking at how they move around each other due to their own gravitational attraction. And when we weigh up all the galaxies, we find out that you only have 30% of the total amount of energy you'd need to account for the overall geometry of the universe, which we've actually also independently measured to be flat. And we can talk about what a flat universe means because it's very non-intuitive. So we're missing 70% of the energy of the universe if we just try and weigh all the stuff around galaxies. And amazingly, totally independently, it turned out we measured the expansion rate of the universe, and if we asked how much energy would you have to put into empty space to get that expansion rate, amazingly, it comes out exactly right, 70%. So everything fits together with this cockamamie universe, 70% of which is dark energy. And by the way, of the matter, almost all of that mass and matter is not the stuff that makes up you and me. It's not the stuff we see. If you look out the night sky and you got rid of all the stars and galaxies and everything we can see, the universe would be largely the same. Because of that 30% of the universe in matter, almost all of it is a kind of matter we cannot see that doesn't shine. And guess what we call it? We call it dark matter. And so most of the universe, 99% of the universe almost, is dark matter and dark energy. And we're a 1% bit of cosmic pollution designed to fill up the radio waves with interesting discussion.
Cosmic pollution, I rather like that idea.
Me too, actually.
But you're talking about the galactic scale. But what about the tiny, tiny scale? Because quantum theory has something to say, doesn't it, that looks as though it could be useful here.
Yeah, it turns out ultimately what affects the universe is the stuff that happens on the very smallest scales. There's two reasons for that, by the way. First of all, the universe is expanding. So long ago, about 13.7 billion years ago, our entire observable universe was contained in a region smaller than the size of an atom. So clearly, what determined the initial conditions of our universe were the fundamental forces and subatomic forces that make up nature. But it's even more interesting than that because we think that we have to understand those quantum mechanical effects to understand both dark matter and dark energy. Because the dark matter particles, we are reasonably convinced, are particles that are unlike the protons and neutrons that make us up. And therefore, we don't see them here. And there's only two places they sort of could have been created. One, at the early universe. Or two, we can try and recreate the conditions of the early universe with a machine here on Earth. And we have. It's the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. On a very small scale, creates conditions that are very similar to what were the energies that were available in the very early universe. And we may actually produce those particles in that accelerator and measure them there. So we're on the vanguard there, trying to discover perhaps what the dark matter is by producing those particles of the Large Hadron Collider. We don't know if that'll be the case or not, but it's certainly a possibility. Then similarly, to understand the dark energy, we think we may have to understand the quantum nature of space, because it turns out that space, according to quantum mechanics and relativity, is a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles that pop in and out of existence in a timescale so short you can't even measure them. Now, that sounds like counting angels on the head of a pin or philosophy or something, but it's not, because while we can't see those virtual particles, as they're called, directly, indirectly, we can measure their effects. And in fact, they affect the properties of atoms in calculable ways. And if we don't include them, in our calculations, we get the wrong answer. And if we do, we get the right answer to nine decimal places of accuracy. It's the best predictions in all of physics. So we understand, in some sense, how those virtual particles affect the properties of matter. What's really weird, and maybe unfortunate or maybe exciting, is when we apply those same calculations to try and calculate the energy of empty space itself, we get the wrong answer. And as wrong as you can be, we get the answer wrong by a factor of at least 10 to the 120, a one with 120 decimal zeros after it. And that's probably the worst calculation in all of physics. And we still don't understand what we're doing wrong, which is, of course, as I say, exciting if you're a theorist.
So what do you think, Ian? Cosmic pollution, that's what we are.
Yeah, no, I love it. And you know, on the one hand, it makes us feel terribly, terribly insignificant. And on the other hand, here we are sitting trying to puzzle all this stuff out. I've always been struck by this cosmological debate about dark matter that's been going on for quite a long time now. Every few weeks, something appears that says, yes, yes, we've definitely proved dark matter exists. And then a week later, you get something that says, oh, we've just proved it doesn't exist. I mean, the latest one that I saw was last week in New Scientist magazine, where there was a double-page spread saying the local area of the galaxy ought to have quite a lot of dark matter in it, and three separate groups have looked for it, and they've not found it. What they've found is that the local movement of the stars around our bit of the universe, everything they're doing is accounted for by the matter that we can actually see. So, there's a case where looking for dark matter has been done and it's not there. And you can come up with all sorts of explanations. But this kind of story seems to keep happening. Dark energy, I'm pretty happy with in some form. This is a genuine phenomenon. Dark matter, the alternatives are that our idea of the law of gravity needs changing, or our idea of the laws of motion needs changing. And I get the feeling that those alternatives are not being explored. They're not being taken quite as seriously as perhaps they ought to be.
Well, you know, I'm going to jump. Can I jump in for
Go
a second?
Ahead.
Yeah, just of course. First of all, as you know, Ian, you shouldn't believe everything you read. But, you know, I think that people make these headlines because they want it to be interesting. And, you know, dark matter it's been killed and reborn many times, and maybe it's like a savior in that way. But what we still are trying to learn the details of it. But in fact, our estimates of the amount of dark matter in the local neighborhood of our galaxy are that it's sort of comparable to the amount of normal matter. And so it's not as if it dominates in the region of our galaxy. And so if it were 50% less, and therefore not quite measurable, it would be interesting, but not revolutionary. So these new observations are interesting because they constrain, you know, how the dark matter is distributed in our galaxy, but they don't invalidate the idea. There's lots of independent estimates that tell us that galaxies are dominated by this stuff. And if you try and do the alternative, which you just mentioned, changing the laws of nature, changing gravity, first of all, one should say that's a much more radical and revolutionary idea than just having dark matter. Having new particles that you can't see is not so surprising. In fact, every kind of new particle we invent in particle physics to help problems in our understanding of the fundamental structure of matter. All of them generally produce these kind of dark matter particles naturally. But changing gravity on a scale suddenly of our galaxy, boy, that's a revolutionary idea. And really, there's no fundamental theoretical reason why we think that's the case. That doesn't mean it's not the case. But
I'm not so sure about that. I hear what you say, and it's very convincing in many ways. But the great success over the past 100 years or so was Einstein coming along and changing the law of gravity. And one of the bits of evidence for that was the precession of the perihelion of Mercury. The planet Mercury, its orbit is changing slightly. And a lot of people tried to explain that with hidden matter, namely a planet called Vulcan. And they even observed Vulcan. And then it turned out Vulcan probably doesn't exist. It's not even clear now. And what we did was change the law of gravity.
You just see what you want to see. Alexander, I want to ask Alexander de Vrindt. We're going to talk in a minute about your play, which is called The History of the Universe. But what about the idea of a performance about dark matter and dark energy? That seems quite a kind of challenge.
It's a beautiful poetic term, of course. But, you know, the thing I have is a little bit as an artist is like every artist always relates to the scientific discoveries of its age. You know, we wouldn't have cubism if it wasn't for quantum mechanics, I think. So I'm always listening, like I'm listening now to these two artists, but I don't have the same awe I have over the equations or things. The only thing I can do is deal with it.
Oh, that's a nice idea, Lawrence, that you're an artist of cosmology.
I love that, being called an artist. That was the nicest thing I've been called in a while.
I had a question which relates on from what Ian was saying, which is the arguments that have been made based on quantum theory, which is about the realm of the very, very small, isn't it? It's about the weird world of things in the subatomic level, the tiny things we can't even see. So why would that be applicable at a cosmic level? Because they're not applicable at the level of you and me. I mean, we don't behave in weird ways where we wink in and out of existence.
Not usually. That's a very good question. The universe on large scales is quite classical. But at the same time, first of all, the existence of elementary particles themselves, we think, in some ways depends upon quantum mechanics. And if this dark matter is some new type of elementary particle, then we have to understand it in the context of our theories of elementary particles. So if the dark matter is a gas of particles, by the way, what makes that so exciting is not just that it's exotic and weird, but it means the dark matter is not just out there. It's in your studio, going right through your body as you're talking, and means we can do experiments here on Earth to look for it, and we are indeed also doing those. So that makes it interesting. But if it's a new type of elementary particle, it means that our theory of elementary particles has to be revised or altered a little bit to account for it, and that's why quantum mechanics works at that scale. But in terms of empty space, because it's classical, classically the energy of nothing should be nothing, and there's no other way around it. And the only way, in some sense, to understand the possibility that empty space weighs something is to consider the weird world of quantum mechanics, which tells us that at some very small scale, strange things are happening and somehow endowing empty space with an energy. We don't understand that at all, but it seems clear to us that if we're going to endow empty space with that new property, the only way to be weird enough to give empty space energy is to apply the weirdest thing we know, which is quantum mechanics. Now, but that doesn't mean it's right.
Ian is saying maybe it's not weird enough. But another question following on from that then. If empty space is nothingness, there is a theory, isn't there, that nothingness can give birth to somethingness, that this might be an answer to how our universe began in that moment before the Big Bang. Well, how does that work?
Well, one of the reasons I call my new book A Universe from Nothing is that our ideas of nothing have changed tremendously. And one of the things I want people to realize is that science has changed the playing field of what we discuss, which is often the case. The example I often use, for example, is that it used to be significant in the time of Kepler to say, why are there five planets, say, because you're looking for platonic solids or something. Now we realize it's just kind of an accident, and we ask, how are there nine planets? Because, by the way, for me, there are always nine planets. Pluto's a planet. I refuse to give up.
But, okay, we've talked about that on the forum.
in any case, so our ideas of nothing have changed because quantum mechanics has told us that nothing is really quite complicated, at least the nothing of empty space. And once you apply quantum mechanics and gravity to empty space, then actually nothing, namely no particles, just pure empty space, is actually unstable. If you wait long enough, you're guaranteed to produce stuff out of it. Without magic, without a creator, without violating any laws of physics, you'll populate a universe with stuff. And that is amazing. But it's even more amazing than that, because if you apply quantum mechanics to space itself and go one step further, actually where we don't even really yet have a firm theory, a theory called quantum gravity, where we apply quantum mechanics to gravity itself, then one of the implications of that certainly seems to be that even space itself can pop in and out of existence. And you can actually create universes, namely space, where there was no space before. And if that's the case, then again, you can understand how you could actually create a whole universe big enough for all of us to live in, full of stuff. Literally, there was no space at the beginning. And those ideas are amazing. And I find it remarkable that we now have a plausible, we don't know for certain, but we have a plausible set of steps that can tell us how you can get space where there was no space, matter where there was no matter, and maybe even the laws of physics where there were no laws before that. And it's that story that I try and tell in the new book.
It does sound like magic, I must say.
It does. And in fact, you know, there's an old story that, you know, if we were visited by beings who were much more technologically advanced than us, it would all seem like magic. And it does seem stranger than fiction. And with respect to Alex, that's the amazing thing I find about the universe, is that it's the imagination of the universe far exceeds the human imagination.
Well, we have here an Ian, actually a science fiction writer, as well as a mathematician.
Yes, some of the time.
Some of the time. Well, that's really relevant to your play, isn't it, Alexander?
Yeah,
the History of the Universe.
It's which a history you directed, of everything, really.
Yeah. Which you directed for your own theatre group based in Ghent in Belgium, I should say, because you tell the history backwards, don't you, from the present day to the Big Bang, which, taking us back to nothing. Mm-hmm. But this is more of a kind of philosophical overview of how we fit into the bigger scheme of things. So I suppose when Lawrence says cosmic pollution, that fits in quite well with your vision and your play, does it?
Yeah, the thing was, I'm listening like I was listening now to Ian and Lawrence talking, and I'm just listening and I'm in awe of the knowledge they have and the stuff that they look for. And luckily there are more and more books to bring it to a layman like me. But the main thing I'm dealing is, which Lawrence jokingly says, like, we're nothing, and we all want you to remember that, is it's true. But how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that as a human being now? And I think, you know, religion tries to do both things, you know, like they try to combine science and philosophy and the answers, and I think it's good.
And they do science, both poorly.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I think if science provides like the facts, I think it's our job to translate this to other human beings and how to deal with that.
And it does sound quite digestible, I must say. I hear that the play has a wild, cartoonish energy. There's a kind of whiz back through 13 billion years, and there are iconic and trivial moments, from toy gun assassinations to cotton wool nuclear explosions, and then the Ice Age, which is scattered confetti. So you're allowing everybody to visualise this extraordinary idea, which we've just been hearing more theoretically about from Lawrence, of where we all came from, which was this Big Bang.
But that's the thing. Mostly when science is used in a play, the poetic license goes very far. And what I wanted to do is I share the same awe over the scientific facts or the knowledge we get, but I wanted to present it to the audience in the right manner. When you will see, for instance, that the universe is born, it will say 13.72 billion years old. When I tang the six things that created the universe, it's all based on facts. Evolution is not... It's really, I really say at a certain point when we share an ancestor with the lungfish. And some people find that funny, which I think is good, because I want to present it in a light way, because I don't want to be didactic or something like that. But still, it's the only way to make the feeling that you're nothing and insignificant digestible is not to use the pointed finger, but is to make that digestible.
I'll jump in for a second and say how happy I am to hear this, because, you know, often sciences claim to be useful just because of technology, because we make better toasters or airplanes or whatever. But for me, what's most interesting about science is the ideas, and I think we need to share them more broadly. And if science can inspire artists, I just think it's the most wonderful thing in the world, because it should. And I'm just so happy Alex is doing this play, because these are the ideas that are so fascinating. You want to share them not just in the context of a dry seminar, but in the context of enjoying them and playing with them and experiencing them, as he's clearly done in his play.
Alexander, read us an extract from the closing scene.
I'm not afraid of the universe. I know some people are. They get terrified when they think of infinite space or black holes, but I don't. No. When I think about me and the Big Bang, I feel a bit obliged. I ask a scientist who I should thank for me being here, who I should thank for our universe to exist, and he told me to thank six things, so he goes. Thanks to the three spatial dimensions I live in. Thanks to the strength between atomic cores, so stars can change hydrogen into all the other atoms. Thanks to a number 10 with 35 zeros that holds all these atoms together. Thanks to the exact amount of dark matter in our universe. Thanks to the power that can break the largest structures in the cosmos. And thanks to anti-gravity that controls the expansion of our universe. I don't know what these six things mean, but thanks for doing this. I know they don't do it for me. They don't care. It doesn't matter to them if I'm happy, miserable, anxious, or dead. But still, they ask nothing in return. I live because of them, and I will die. We're all gonna die, and that makes us the lucky ones.
I think that's extraordinary.
Thank you.
I love it, like Lawrence. I love it.
And do those match your top six things that you'd thank the universe for?
They come pretty close.
They're based on the book Martin Rees.
You have to realise in 20 years' time, what we think the scientific theory of all of this stuff will probably be very different, but it will have grown out of what's happening at the moment. And but what science does is, instead of saying that the universe was made for us, we're important, and everything else there is somehow, it's there in order to lead up to us, which I think is extraordinarily silly, you can still say, yeah, but we're not totally insignificant. It's what we make of it that matters to us. And after all, you know, we get to choose in that sense. The universe can do something very, very, you know, the sun can blow up tomorrow and that's it. And I don't think the sun's sitting there in some way thinking, I really don't want to do that.
And we are there to thank the universe. Maybe no one else is thanking
maybe
the universe.
We may be the only ones thanking it. But, of course, the universe doesn't care about our thanks, as Alex points out. And I think that, for me, is energizing. And, you know, for some people it's depressing that the universe doesn't care about us. But as Ian just said, for me it's the exact opposite. It means the meaning in our lives, or meaning that we create. And we realize that we're just incredibly fortunate to be here at this random spot in the middle of nowhere at this time where we can have these fascinating discussions and try and actually have learned about the universe from the earliest moments of the Big Bang to the far future, and we can observe these incredible things that are happening and enjoy them and write plays about them. And so we create our own meaning. And for some reason, for some people, that depresses them. But for me, it's the exact opposite. If some cosmic Saddam Hussein was creating meaning in my life, I'd feel pretty disappointed.
This is The Forum from the BBC World Service. Today, a programme about nothingness, the vastness of empty space, and the infinitely small pieces it's made of. But now it's time for our 60-second idea to change the world. And this week it comes from Belgian theatre director Alexander de Vriend. Alexander, you've got just 1 minute to win over me, Bridget Kendall, and my other two guests, British mathematician Ian Stewart and American cosmologist Lawrence Krauss. And, of course, you, the BBC World Service audience. So, Alexander, if you're ready, your minute starts now.
My idea to change the world is to make our life in the supermarket just that little bit easier. Each major company will be allocated a single letter, and they will have to name all their products starting with that letter. No more false names or washing products that sound like soup, no. The letter will be the main thing on the package, plus a very dry description of what the product actually is. This will first of all make it easier to find products in the supermarket, and at least then I would know from which company I'm buying. Actually, I would have a clear overview of how few companies make everything I put in my trolley. I would probably even need all the 26 letters in the alphabet. There will be exceptions for very small companies. They will get a number to start their name with. And no tricks from the major companies by dividing production line or something like that, no. Or as a punishment, they get letter X or Y. So my idea to change a better world is that we stop buying letters and more numbers.
Thank you very much, Alexander. And that's very appropriate, given that we've got a mathematician in the studio. This idea of stripping the wrapping paper off the things we buy which also strips bare just how few companies, in fact, who control everything. But what I wonder is, wouldn't you also strip away the joy of retail therapy if everything was reduced to numbers and letters? Ian Stewart, would you mind it if all the enticing bars of chocolate looked the same on the shelf? Maybe as a mathematician used to the clarity of numbers, you wouldn't mind at all.
I would probably find in some ways that I was disappointed because they didn't look as exciting. But then I'm eating too many chocolate bars anyway, and this would genuinely help. But I like the idea in that one of the big problems nowadays is everyone is shouting enormously loudly so as to be heard over the din of everybody else shouting. So advertisers want to, it's ever bigger and louder and more, you know, you have neon signs. We're going to have chocolate bars which have moving holographic video on the wrapper soon. Wouldn't it be an idea to all step back and say, we're wasting a huge amount of time, money and energy on this. Tell me what I actually want to know about your product. Mm-hmm. Don't try and con me into buying it when I don't really want it. No. Don't try to lie to me. Don't tell me about 7,000 ingredients I don't care about. Tell me about the salt and sugar content, which I do care about. It would be lovely to be able to do it. I'd be surprised if we ever could. But Alexander's proposal is certainly pointing in a good direction.
You think it could be a start? What about you, Lawrence Cross? You're a cosmologist. You must be used to looking at planets and stars as numbers and letters.
Well, in some sense, truth in advertising is a great thing. On the other hand, it's nice to look at planets and stars and enjoy their beauty. And so, you know, I was just thinking about the fact that what would happen? You wouldn't be able to use sex to sell this stuff anymore, and it'd be a lot less fun. You know, say, have it. You wouldn't be able to see a sexy woman on the cover saying, "Isn't A wonderful?" and so I don't know. I might find that a little less enjoyable.
I'm kind of with you on that. I also think, Alexander, I don't think 26 letters will be enough because there'll be all the variations. So you start ending up with equations like the sort of things in Ian's books that you'd have to remember in order to remember what was on your shopping list.
I understand, but the main thing is like there are probably only 10 companies that buy everything. Or that make everything I buy or make everything I eat. And I would just have that little help to point me in the direction of companies that don't do that.
I love that idea. I agree with you that it would really, the fact that so few companies own most of everything we use, I think that making that explicit would be great because you're right, helping the small companies is a great idea.
I think there's a thumbs up
on everyone on that one. Thank you, Alexander. And we've had lots of good comments on Facebook on last week's idea that all soldiers should be required to do a stint in a care home using their muscles to help look after the elderly. Damien Flinter in Ireland thought he would never catch on. Bush Moe was also sceptical, writing, "Soldiers are trained to kill, not care." But Christopher Wilsey disagreed. "Don't believe the Hollywood hype," he said. "True professional soldiers are not sadistic. It's the politicians," he said, "who need to be sent to care homes to learn compassion." Meanwhile, Lauren Brewer Clark in Houston is all for it. "Sure," she wrote, "when I'm 80, I'd love a hot, muscular guy to feed and bathe me." Thanks for all your comments. And to add your own, details as usual are on our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com and follow the links to the forum. Now, we were talking earlier about space and nothingness, but what happens if you get as close to nothing as you can without actually crossing the threshold? In mathematics, it's a concept known as infinitesimals. And Ian Stewart, you're the perfect person to explain it to us. As well as being Professor of Mathematics at Warwick University, you're well known here in the UK as a populariser of maths, with a string of books to your name, including, as I said, some science fiction. You've called infinitesimals slices of nothingness. So what are they?
They are numbers that are smaller than any number you can name, except zero. So if I sit there saying, I'm going to think of something really, really small, I'm going to think of 1 billionth, you know, 0.00000, lots of noughts, one.
And then halve it.
And then halve it, smaller than that. Throw in another 100 noughts, it's smaller than that. Throw in a billion noughts, it's smaller than that. Can I write down in decimals what it looks like? No. It's something slightly different.
But can you then have, you talk about infinitesimals, so can you have several? And are there any difference between them?
That's the big breakthrough of the last 50 years, that if you allow yourself to have several rather than thinking there should only be one of these things, You need entire families of these. You have as many infinitesimals as you have numbers. They're all different from each other. If you multiply two of them together, you get another one of them. You know, it's just like ordinary numbers. 3 times 4 is 12. We've already created a new number out of 3 and 4. 3 plus 4 is 7. All that's different
so
again.
So how do you know which one to use?
For a lot of purposes, it doesn't matter. You use any of them. And that's the wonderful thing, because at the end of the calculation, if you've got a little infinitesimal bit left over, you throw it away again. But the mathematics guarantees that whichever one you started with, and no matter what it is that you throw away, the answer that remains is always the same, and it's the one you thought it ought to be.
This so, sounds just like convenience.
It does, doesn't it? Well, it is rather surprising. But, for example, the circumference of a circle... 2 pi times the radius. How do you know that that works for different radii? How do you know that a circle twice as big has twice the circumference? I mean, it makes sense. Now, if they were polygons, straight-sided figures, you can prove it using Euclid's geometry. But for curves like the circle, that doesn't really work. Now, the seductive, tempting way to go is say, I think a circle is really made up of infinitely many infinitesimally long straight lines stuck together. So it's just like a polygon. And if I apply the geometry of polygons, that explains everything and it all works out beautifully. But if I'm really, really pedantic, and mathematicians can out-pedantic anyone on the planet, you know, we're trained to. Mm-hmm. Maybe not philosophers, but I think they're sort of...
mathematics has content.
Mathematicians, anyway. Math has content. Well, the joke says that all a mathematician needs to work is a pencil and paper and a waste paper basket, and philosophers don't need the waste paper basket. the mathematics of this is lovely, but hang on. A circle, even if I had infinitesimal straight lines, there'd still be little straight bits. A circle's curved everywhere. It's not exactly this infinitely many-sided polygon of infinitesimal sides. It's infinitesimally different from that. And you can sort of go round and round in circles. And where this all came to a head and where it's really important, because among other things, it's how we solve the equations of quantum mechanics and relativity and all of the stuff that Lawrence was talking about. Somewhere in this you say, how do you know that? And somebody says, well, you solve the Einstein field equations and you get... And this is all based on calculus. Calculus goes back to Newton and Leibniz. And calculus is about rates of change. I'm driving my car. How fast is it going? Oh, well, it took us an hour to go 50 miles, so it's 50 miles an hour. Look, sorry, you're stuck in a traffic jam at the moment. You're not doing 50 miles an hour at the moment. Oh, no, that's the average over the whole journey. Yes, but what are we doing now? And Newton sort of says, well, OK, think of where we are now. Go 1 second into the future, see how far we've gone. It's that distance per second. But a real pedant can come along and say, come on, Isaac, that's the average over that second. Actually, we're going slightly different speeds at different times during that second.
Then you need to chop it up into
infinite. You need to chop it up, but it doesn't matter what size you chop it up into. The same objection can be raised. It's not exact. There's a little error. Now, Newton and Leibniz both sort of knew what was going on, but when they tried to put it into words and symbols, it always sounded a bit fuzzy. So Newton talked about things he called fluxions, which are quantities that flow towards zero but never quite get there.
So it's interesting what you're saying, given what we were talking to Lawrence about earlier. These are basically dodgy numbers, aren't they?
These are.
Because you can't actually define them. You can't say where the borderline is. You can't name them. But they... you were saying about the last 50 years, they've become very useful to deal with what turns out to be quite dodgy science.
But to support, Ian, the point is they're well-defined in a sense that you can do mathematics and give rules. Now, the rules defy common sense, which is one of the reasons I love infinitesimals and infinite quantities, is that the common sense rules don't work anymore. But we can nevertheless derive rules that are perfectly consistent that allow us to solve the equations of the universe and predict things and build things. But the fact that they defy common sense makes it even more interesting, because it once again demonstrates to us that the universe, you know, that what we think of as common sense does not necessarily really describe the universe.
So you use them in your work all the time, Lawrence?
Oh, of course. My whole work depends upon them. And the fact that they're well-defined ways of dealing with them, and they lead to results that that we can compare with the universe tells us that the rules make sense, that the mathematics that Newton and Leibniz invented is, in fact, the right language to describe nature. And yet, as I say, it defies our common sense. It's true. What's kind of nice, again, in fact, it connects to what we said earlier in the hour, is that there's a connection between infinitesimals and infinity in the same way as there's a connection between ultra-small and ultra-big. The infinitesimals have the rules that are basically similar rules that we use to describe infinities. And one of my favorite T-shirts, which was given to me by my lovely partner, says 2 + 2 = 5 in the limit of extremely large values of 2. And I think that demonstrates, in fact, what's so wonderful is that when you come with very large numbers or very small numbers, you have to bend the rules, but you can do it in well-defined ways.
Alexander, this just confirms what you were saying at the beginning, doesn't it? That Ian, as a mathematician, and Lawrence, as a cosmologist, are artists like you who deal with things that are not commonsensical.
That's the thing. Yeah, that's the thing. But the only thing I have here is that when I think about the idea of infinitesimals, it feels more like Lawrence said, like you use it, and that's why we have probably microwaves and satellites. But the thing is, I get generally out of it, I link it with Lawrence's idea a little bit that zero doesn't exist, nothing doesn't exist. Maybe that's not true in the right word, but that's a very comforting thought I take with me from both of their discoveries or the things they're talking about.
That if we're fuzzy around zero, where is zero, Ian?
Well, it doesn't exist.
Mathematics manages to combine fuzziness and precision at the same time. And what emerged in the last 50 years is there is a really entirely... What happened before that, after Newton and before 50 years ago, and in fact what people still mostly do, is there is a form of words that makes sense of Newton's idea of flowing towards zero but never actually getting there. And we teach it to all undergraduates in analysis courses, which is rigorous calculus. And they all have real trouble with it when they first come across it, and it takes getting used to. But it's a form of words that makes sense, and it is in fact logical. But what happened about 50 years ago was that the mathematical logicians discovered you can actually go back to infinitesimals and you can use that language and you can set up a mathematical structure and you don't need this fancy form of words. You can do everything the way Archimedes would have liked to have done it. Archimedes was such a clever mathematician, he knew that it didn't work. The Greeks were good logicians. Archimedes would have loved what we now know because what turns out, it does work. But you have to do what Lawrence said. If you've got an infinitesimal and you divide by it, you get an infinity. Mm-hmm. And if you take two different infinitesimals and do that, you get two different infinities. So you have this system of ordinary numbers, infinitesimals, infinities, smaller order infinitesimals. An infinitesimal multiplied by an infinitesimal is smaller than any other infinitesimal, and so on and so forth. It sounds extraordinarily bizarre, but also very fruitful. And out comes a very nice mathematical structure, which actually works.
Can I jump in?
Sure.
Do I stretch then if, you know, that you could say something like there are different sort of infinities? Could you link that to parallel universe? Because I remember reading something by Brian Greene. Or is that too far stretching it?
As an analogy or a metaphor, I think it's fine. There's a question here whether the imagination of the physical world, Lawrence said the universe is stranger than we can imagine, in effect. Mathematics is about as strange as we can imagine, but it can't get any stranger than that because we're the ones doing it.
Yeah. Well, let me answer both questions. I think this, the analogy is a little stretched, Alex. I don't think you need to go to different kinds of infinity to imagine. In fact, I know you don't, to imagine parallel universes of different sorts that we imagine in physics. But the interesting thing about mathematics, though, is in some sense it's wilder than our universe because, as the physicist Richard Feynman used to say, science is imagination in a straitjacket. You can imagine many things, but we're constrained to those things which agree with reality, and that's determined by experiment. And mathematics imagines many possible universes, the mathematics of many different kinds of universes in many different ways, and only one of them we live in a sense. And so mathematics allows for possibilities that are far, in some sense, far wilder than those of our universe. But what's interesting is we are often driven to new mathematics – by looking at our universe. Just like Newton, in some sense, was driven to new mathematics not so much by the interest of doing pure mathematics, but by the need to understand the world around us. And so there's that wonderful interplay between understanding our universe requiring new mathematics and then mathematics leading us to new understanding of our universe.
Florence Krauss, Alexander de Vrinch and Ian Stewart, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next week, a program about second chances with a Chinese novelist, a war photographer, and the man whose flexible prosthetic foot is revolutionising life for amputees. But for now, from me, Bridget Kendall, and all of us here on the Forum, do have a good week. And as usual, for a brief rest from the human voice before the news, we leave you with birdsong. And this week, it's the cactus wren, which, as I'm sure you know, Lawrence, is the state bird of Arizona.
If you've enjoyed this BBC podcast, why not try others, such as Start the Week with Andrew Marr? To find out more, visit bbc.com/podcast.